We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
Nine, ten.
It's not ten. You see, you're on ten here. Where can you go from there? Where?
To 11.
11, exactly.
11.
Midway. So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and McKnight on the Score.
We talked about the Bears. We looked at the CBSSports.com and Sportsline metric projections for the playoffs. They have the Bears as the NFC North champion and the 3 seed in the NFC. We then talked with Mike Florio, had a basketball conversation with Vincent Goodwill, a little bit about the Bulls, their non-existent defense, and the ridiculous Jimmy Butler saga. I'll disagree with Vinny about Jimmy Butler being a top 10 player. I think the market is showing you pretty much where Jimmy is right now. So that was much of the discussion so far today on Bernstein and McKnight.
Told you that we have to say goodbye to something that it's probably overdue to say goodbye to. I think we touched on this a little bit yesterday, but I don't think we gave it its due. After 71 years, the Cleveland Indians are finally going to stop using the Chief Wahoo mascot on their uniforms.
Good riddance.
Yeah, it's overdue. I know there's a lot of people who disagree, and it's just a caricature, or it's just a cartoon, or what have you. But it's pretty clear that that has absolutely had its time, and its place is gone now. It's still going to exist. You know, they're still going to make money off of it, so I don't know that necessarily, you know, in like team shops and old school jerseys.
Well, you
and
can't
all that kind
make
of stuff.
Something go away. You can stop using it officially on your uniforms,
right? But they're not going to stop making trademarked license stuff and selling it in team shops and around the ballpark and all that stuff. It's still going to exist in terms of a consumer level for fans and whatnot. So I don't know that they deserve all of the credit that I'd like to give them for getting rid of it, but they are getting rid of it. And remember, it's not us. It's not all everybody. Jim Tomei didn't want to wear it going into the Hall of Fame. He wanted the Block C instead of that. And that is going to be, I guess, the logo that they're going to, that Block C for Cleveland. So good. Good riddance. It's not something that needs to be used anymore. It probably never needed to be used. It had its time, and it went away a long, long time ago. Hopefully it's staying away. And hopefully it's something for a lot of other teams to consider as well, like that football team in Washington.
There may be a hockey team here. We also have to say goodbye to Lorraine Sullum.
What happened to Lorraine?
Vermont police say 84-year-old Lorraine Sullum was killed in a car crash while leaving a cemetery.
Oh,
authorities say the crash happened at Pittsfield Village Cemetery on September 29th. Sullum was driving up a gravel hill at the cemetery around 9 a.m. when her car began to go off the road, so she put her vehicle in reverse to correct the issue. Her car ended up rolling down an embankment. She was not wearing a seatbelt. She died at the scene. Her funeral was held Friday. She was buried at the Pittsfield Village Cemetery. So I ask you, can we get a ruling?
Yes.
Is this irony?
Yes. Yes, that's irony. That's irony.
Yep, you're already there. You might as well.
Killed by the very cemetery you're trying to leave?
Yes. Okay, I think that's pretty close. There's some things. Sometimes you end up with some positive versions of this. My father had a friend who was walking down the street in New York and had a massive heart attack directly in front of the Cornell Medical Center's heart clinic.
If you're going to pick
that's
a place
right?
to have the massive heart attack.
It literally happened to be right there. It was a massive heart attack right outside the front door of Cornell Medical Center.
I mean, other than visiting your friend who's in the hospital for a massive heart attack in the unit where that treats heart attacks,
right.
That's the place to be. I like you, Dan, get a phone call at the same time every day. I don't know this person. I've never been to Bayonne, New Jersey, but I get a phone call.
Is it Don Cooper?
At night, it's not. It's
whoa,
not
whoa,
Coop.
Whoa, Chief. Whoa.
Or maybe, I don't know, maybe Coop changed his number. He used to call and text with emojis and that kind of stuff. That was fun. But no, at 9:45 every morning and about 3:30 in the afternoon, I get a call from Bayonne, New Jersey. It is a robocall.
Okay.
Is it an automated, generated call that comes to my cell phone despite the fact that I never asked for this? Well, it's good news from the FCC, which is just kind of an oxymoron. 35 states yesterday finally filed the FCC to stop robocalls. There is a new bipartisan effort to stop the annoying as hell calls that come into your phone.
Now,
hopefully this is something that they do.
Or landline, because you don't have a landline anymore.
No, I don't. And nor have I ever, nor will I ever have a landline.
We do have a landline just because we're old, and we know every time it rings, it is either her parents, my parents, or a robocall.
That's right.
Every single time.
There's no point. There's no point in having the line. There's no point in picking it up. And it's the same way for most of the phone calls I get on my cell phone.
We have the line because that's where our doorbell rings through.
And it's probably free. I mean, really, when you think, the landline probably comes free with the cable and the internet that you've already subscribed to. It's probably $2 a month added on to your subscription or whatever.
We have DirecTV, though.
Oh, well, that changes that math. Even still, get rid of your landline. Anyway, 35 states, the attorneys general of 35 states have signed this thing. And yes, Lisa Madigan of Illinois is one of them. So hopefully our long nightmare is over.
Police had to remove a woman who brought an emotional support squirrel on a Frontier Airlines flight headed from Orlando, Florida to Cleveland. The passenger had noted in her reservation she was bringing an emotional support animal with her on Flight 1612 Tuesday night, but she did not indicate that it was a squirrel.
What?
The airline says rodents, including squirrels, are not allowed. Police were called when the passenger refused to leave the plane. Police requested the other passengers disembark while officers dealt with the woman, who eventually was escorted into the main terminal. The flight left for Cleveland about 2 hours later. It's one thing to have the emotional support squirrel. It is another thing to then refuse to give it up when you're told to give it up.
How more neurotic an animal can you find to be an emotional support animal?
Something that jumpy?
Why? How is that emotionally supportive? It's a squirrel. It's not the water skiing squirrel that we see every year on the news.
Do you know that
right?
For sure?
Zippy?
I suppose I don't. I don't know that for sure.
I think maybe you've just, maybe that's an accomplished squirrel. Meanwhile, the squirrels in general have been jumpy.
I don't see a lot of squirrels in the neighborhood.
I don't know that they sense something's going on, but around me, they're all over the place. They're making those loud noises from the trees when you walk by. There's like two chasing each other in a spiral around a tree trunk.
I think it's the weather, the back and forth,
yeah,
the yo-yo.
There's something weird going on. I don't know what's up, but they've been acting very, very strangely. And I don't know, I've seen a couple coyotes around us too. Maybe they're just fearful of the coyotes. I'm not sure.
This is, no one dies in this story, thankfully, so I feel good reading it. We've already had too much death on the midday midway. This may also be irony. You tell me. Woman stabs friend after unknowingly given real knife at Tennessee haunted house. What started out as a Halloween fun for a group of friends in Nashville turned into real horror when a woman says she was approached by someone and unknowingly given a real knife, which was used to stab her friend. Metro police are investigating the stabbing that happened Friday night at Nashville Nightmare, a popular Halloween attraction. At this attraction, people
dressed
up
banners,
Halloween costumes, and roam the grounds, interacting with guests and working carnival-type games. According to an incident report from the police, officers were told that a group of four friends had gone to Nashville Nightmare. While inside the venue, they were approached by someone who they thought was a character there. Nashville Nightmare says they also believe the person involved was an employee who has since been placed on leave. The woman who was handed the knife says the group had already gone inside Haunted House, was playing carnival-type games when it happened in the roped-off area, thought it was a fake knife, stabbed the friend. She's okay. Don't go to Haunted Houses. I think that's the end of the story. Don't go to Haunted Houses.
Yeah, I don't. Life is scary enough. Like, actually, just turn on the news.
any of the news channels, anyone.
Look at your phone in the morning. All news is awful all the time.
Even the weather report at this point.
Everything is horrible all the time and getting worse, no matter what. And the moment you think that you look at this news story and you go, oh, that might not be as bad as I think, it's definitely worse. No matter, just the way things are now, the moment you there's a piece of news, the moment there's like your phone set for an alert, or if anybody just calls you and say, hey, did you hear, no matter what it is, it's not only bad, it's way, way, way worse than you actually think it is.
Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome. Now, this story's got some details in it that I had to get my head around, because I saw the headline and I realized it wasn't what was fun about it. If you got, speaking of robocalls.
Yeah.
If you got incessant phone calls last week from a hospital that cares for Hawaiian monk seals, you were butt-dialed, or more specifically, foot-dialed by a gecko.
Wait, what?
Hang with me here. Marine mammal veterinarian Claire Simeone was at lunch when she got a call from Kaikaiola, the Big Island Hospital where she's director. There was silence on the other end. Nine more silent calls followed, and fearing a seal emergency, she rushed back. She wasn't the only one getting calls, and people started asking why the hospital was calling nonstop. Trying to figure out why a bazillion calls were made from one line, she called the phone company, and a rep tried to talk her through finding a possible line. And apparently, it was a gecko that was standing on the phone, dialing with its feet.
Not a loose seal.
It was not a loose seal ball. It was a gecko. But that's not the point here. And yes, everybody made the jokes about the gecko actually calling to sell insurance.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But there's a hospital in Hawaii
that's right.
That specifically cares for seals.
You think they sell seals?
I don't know.
They sell and train seals?
I don't know. And maybe, is it R&B singer Seal? Is that what he, would you consider
yeah,
R&B?
Yeah, I think that's an R&B singer. You know, little known fact about seals, once they get the taste for human flesh, unstoppable.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that.
And my mother has nothing to do with this.
That is the midday midway. We do it every day here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. When we come back, you know, we get Jake Jaffe coming up at 11:40, so some Hall of Fame conversation and some baseball playoff conversation to get to with him. But there is there's a manager's triangle going on in Major League Baseball right now, and a lot of those points are connected right here in Chicago, just a couple of miles north at Wrigley Field. We'll tell you how David Ross, Joe Maddon, Aaron Boone might all be conjoined. When we come back, he's Dan, I'm Connor, 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Buster was far from ready to go swimming in the ocean. And Buster is on his way when he decides to pursue a long-delayed rite of passage.
Lucille! Watch out for Lucille!
Let him come on, Lucille! Stay alive!
And then a seal bites off his hand.
Ridiculous premise in that whole show, and they set up, they show you what's going to happen, like starting with episode one, and they finally do it in season two. It's great.
This segment's brought to you by Timeshare Exit Team. Annual timeshare maintenance fees are hitting the mail just in time for the holidays. If it's time to get out, call Timeshare Exit Team. They'll get you out legally and forever. Call 844-915-EXIT or timeshareexitteam.com. Baseball.
Yeah, you've seen the report where apparently the Twins, who just fired a Hall of Famer and Paul Molitor as their manager, are interested in David Ross, potentially, as their manager. The 41-year-old former Cub catcher and current special assistant to the anybody who calls him from the Cubs front office. That guy, they're interested. So I wonder, you know, and as we start the whole carousel of managers, which might grow by, I don't know, we'll see. See if it grows by a number or so from those who are in the playoffs. Aaron Boone leaves. His Yankees leave the playoffs last night after some, you know, crazy calls from Angel Hernandez and an amorphous strike zone that was also applied there too. Aaron Boone, I want to start with him because the way he managed his Yankees over those four games against the Boston Red Sox felt And many have pointed this out. I don't claim this as my own. It's very well pointed out. And it was defended by Boone in some of the post games. He managed some of this stuff like a regular season game. He left starters in to take damage, whether it was Severino. It doesn't really matter whether it was CC Sabathia.
With that bullpen, you should not have a slow hook.
He was given a bullpen, whether it's Britton, whether it's Robertson, whether it's Chapman, whether it's Betances. I mean, my God, the arms you could have brought out there to hopefully stymie the Red Sox offense just a little bit were weapons for you, and he didn't use them. Now, on the other hand, is an offense that was completely shut down by the Red Sox, whether that was Rick Porcello or Chris Sale out of the bullpen or Craig Kimbrell, who got a little herpy in the ninth last night and certainly made for a fun finish. A challenge, a walk-off challenge to end that game last night, too. You had an instance where the manager, Aaron Boone, who was brought out of the broadcast booth with no prior managerial experience, didn't learn at the feet of A.J. Hinch like Alex Cora did, didn't spend time around other managers, didn't spend time running teams, or even in a front office kind of understanding best practices, potentially managing or understanding best practices for managers. You had Aaron Boone just kind of do his thing. You had Aaron Boone, who granted his lineup didn't do much for you, but that doesn't excuse managing to win games. That doesn't excuse leaving your starters in. Well, you're down five, and if you're not hitting, what does it matter if you give up more? No, you've got to manage to win games. You've got to manage the way
it's an elimination game.
Alex Cora managed, bringing Chris Sale out of the bullpen. And I understand some of the problems people had with bringing Chris Sale out of the pen, but look at the way Craig Kimbrell got all kinds of loose in the ninth. If it's not Chris Sale, if he doesn't get the shutdown inning in the eighth, and Kimbrell doesn't have the three-run lead to work with, maybe you're playing one more game. Maybe that one inning from Chris Sale saved you two more games in a series. Saved you one more game in a series for sure.
So connect the dots here. You had a manager in Boone doing things that were inadvisable and maybe because he's inexperienced, out of practice, etc.
So if you're the Minnesota Twins and you're, my God,
yeah.
Damn it, Neil, just put it down on the table in here, and it's Chicken, by the way. It's not Dan. He's fine. We'll get back to that in a second. So if you're David Ross, right, or if you're the Twins and you're seeking David Ross, are you so enamored as a new front office, as a front office that has embraced the metrics for the first time in franchise history, the Minnesota Twins, are you that enamored with the young, presumably pliable manager, given what you've seen in the playoffs? Furthermore, if you're the Cubs, and some of the conversation around your manager and Joe Maddon, celebrity 64-year-old Joe Maddon, guy who knows what he wants and is going to get what he wants in circumstances, a guy who's not gotten the extension and is managing in the last year of his contract, where presumably David Ross is being retained by that front office for something, does this press the gas pedal for anybody?
I don't know.
Does this move things around?
Look, because the Cubs are so methodical in the way they've approached managers. Let's not forget that when in the process of hiring Ricky Renteria, do you remember what those interviews were like?
Hellish.
They took
reportedly
all day. Remember Pete Maccannon? He came out and meeting the media was part of the audition. And Pete Maccannon looked like he had been through like he's been on the hike, the Drew McGarry story. Like he came out of that there. He's been on the jaunt, and he didn't take the sleeping gas before he went on the jaunt. Longer than you think. Ah! And Pete Maccannon is just like, wow, there's a lot going on. They throw things at you. It's an 8-hour thing. The intensity of it. If they really have been around David Ross enough to think that he would be a candidate to make it through that, to impress them with their mechanism for screening managers, then maybe they know more about David Ross than we do. I don't know how he is strategically. We know that he was a well-thought-of oracle as an old catcher.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to interview and potentially hire a guy that you think is going to align with the front office's view on baseball. But then you get the guy in, and you start not being able to manage bullpens the way that they've asked you to manage bullpens. You start holding on to starters because you've seen this guy or that guy hang in there before and get it right in the fifth. You start managing the way Aaron Boone did. And while it didn't necessarily cost the Yankees, it certainly didn't help them win in that series against the Red Sox. Maybe it was always going to be Astros and Red Sox maybe regardless of how Boone managed, you had that. But now Brian Cashman has something that he's got to work with Aaron Boone on. He's got an issue where either he can't or doesn't understand the best practices in that short series, given a weapon the way the bullpen had been shaped for the Yankees.
And the whole idea of hiring somebody like that is to say that this guy doesn't, he's not coming in with any set in his ways and preconceived notions. And you would think that that's already been discussed. Like, look, we're not going out of this series without maximizing one of our strengths, and that's the bullpen.
Yeah, but I don't think that's true. I don't think a guy comes into a position as a former baseball player, as a former catcher specifically, without preconceived notions. He's played baseball for 25 years. He's got preconceived notions about what needs to happen, about what pitchers can and can't do, and how you manage a baseball game. There's going to be a point where, whether it's Joe and Theo disagreeing on the philosophy of baseball, which they openly admit that they do and have good conversations about, whether it's those two guys or whether it's brand new manager X and a brand new front office, there's going to be points where the guy who's played baseball for 25 years goes up against how the front office wants the game to be managed.
And is also going to default to his comfort level and his upbringing at sometimes the most critical times.
And I'm saying, if right? you're going to default to some of those things, I'd rather have the guy who's got some experience in having been a bench coach or learned with a manager who's also gone to, I mean, everybody talks about A.J. Hinch as this guy who helped Alex Cora to where he is, and that's true and well and good, but let's not forget, as a first-time manager, A.J. Hinch with the Diamondbacks was an outright disaster.
Yeah, even a guy like Gabe Kapler, who was a minor league manager, young, and then also worked in a front office, got himself some different perspectives before he was deemed by anyone to be ready to do what he's doing now.
So if you're going to pick a guy that's going to, at some point, the job of a manager is going to at some point make that guy fall back on his default positions, I'd rather have those default positions formed a little bit having been in the fire, not just having been a catcher for a little while. And that's not to say David Ross can't make a good manager. Maybe he can. But if you're seeing the struggles that Aaron Boone has had in the playoffs, coming out of a broadcast booth, coming out of a place of being able to see the game from 30,000 feet like Theo likes people to see it from, there's also something to be said about learning how the clock works in baseball, too. Understanding how quickly those decisions have to be made and how quickly bullpen arms have to be up. It's not every manager, not every team can stomach the growing pains like Gabe Kapler had, not having a guy ready out of the bullpen early in the season. We thought that was going to tank a year for them.
And that's just looking at tactics. That's not even looking at stuff like taking Dave Martinez as an example. Here's Dave Martinez, who's had multiple interviews, who's been Joe Maddon's right hand, who's been this well-respected bench coach and longtime player, etc., and struggled with his locker room. Struggled all year with some of the psychology stuff. And it wasn't necessarily when to have a guy ready in the bullpen. It wasn't lineup construction over the course of a season. It wasn't trying to keep guys happy with playing time or developing. It was the way they felt about coming to work is what he seemed to struggle with.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a way to manager-proof a roster, especially, you know, given injuries and everything. The best laid plans go awry. But the way managers have been hired over the last couple of years, and there are some pretty high-profile openings, or at least interesting openings for teams in this offseason, I think as much as the young, inexpensive, which I think is a giant point here in the managerial search for a lot of teams, but also somewhat flexible type manager, I'd rather have that guy with a little bit of experience, with a little bit of feet in the fire experience than just pure broadcast stuff.
The bottom of the hour is brought to you by Northwestern Basketball. Coach Collins and Northwestern Basketball return to the new Welsh Ryan Arena on November 2nd. Season tickets on sale at nusports.com. And as we discuss this, we know that the Cubs have announced that Joe Maddon is going to return for the final year of his contract. Everybody involved probably mature right. enough that they can deal with him as a lame duck manager. There was this note from the Sun-Times.
Mm-hmm.
This is Michael Sneed who had this. The big question: what's happening to the much-anticipated plans for Cubs manager Joe Maddon's eatery, to be named Joe's, with Spiaggia chef Tony Mantuano at the park at Wrigley, adjacent to Wrigley Field? It sure seems as if nothing much is happening yet, said a top Chicago foodie who's been keeping an eagle eye on the eatery's development at the corner of Waveland and Clark. In February, much was said about its concept and plan. It doesn't feel like much has been happening lately, the source said. Wonder if a perceived delay has anything to do with the Cubs' failure to make a deep playoff run this season and Madden reassessing his future.
Wouldn't it have more to do with just not having an extension? I mean, wouldn't that be common sense for everybody involved if you're going to sink a ton of money into a restaurant and then lose all that money, because that's what restaurants do for the first 5 years, right? You would have to check up a little bit on your future plans if the face of your restaurant isn't necessarily going to be around.
Yeah, but he has a restaurant in Tampa. Well, you don't have to be here to have a restaurant. You know, Jerry DiNardo's still got his place in Bloomington.
But how long was he – when did the restaurant go up in terms of his
It went
Tampa
up while
Bay
he was
tenure?
There, right?
Right.
It did.
It would be
because he was there for a long time. So if it went up halfway through his tenure, let's say, for sake of argument, then it still made a lot of sense.
It's speculation. And
it's valid speculation
because he's got 1 year left on his deal and no contract extension. And maybe if you're Tony Mantuano, it's not necessarily Joe himself. It could be everybody else involved in a restaurant investment saying, well, you know, unless we have a guarantee that you're going to be around for it and be the name that we want, what's the point of doing it if we're not going
to
do it?
I mean, back to the baseball side of it, too. I can't imagine that any sort of speculation about David Ross in an interview with the Twins or anything like that changes the long-term plans of the Cubs or changes the short-term plans of the
Cubs.
Right,
accelerates. Somehow we can't lose David Ross. I don't think they look at it that way. I think they like David Ross. At no point did I hear him looked at as a can't-miss managerial prospect that you can't let get out of the building.
I don't know that there are really a lot of those can't-miss managerial prospects.
Especially because the nature of the job is such that the era of the powerful manager is going away.
I think that's probably true, but I think you'll have a new brand of powerful manager. It's just going to take a while for the manager, you know, just kind of the concept of one who operates the way a front office does, to take control then of some of the new things that we see as new things, whether it's bullpenning or whether it's playoff usage of bullpen arms or whether it's lineup construction or variable defenses, all that kind of stuff. That will become mainstream. And then the application of different facets within those progressive ideas now are going to become what is now the powerful manager. The idea that right now a powerful manager lets a starter go eight because he's John Lester or, you know, whatever. That's the powerful manager.
Yeah, leave him in for five to get him the win.
Yeah, exactly. That will just change to another facet of the game. That will just rotate to another more sabermetrically advanced idea, whatever that is, whatever that happens to be for that team.
No, there's going to be more Brian Snitkers. There's going to be more people who are respected for their tactics and are going to be, I think in large part, the value in your manager is going to be as a six-month front man. You know, and that's the guy that's going to talk every single day in the dugout, who's going to be your face and your voice, your front guy.
Well, look at how teams are constructing themselves, too, whether it's the Brewers now or the Yankees or even the Red Sox to a degree. They're trying to manager-proof the bullpen. Look at all the arms that are in there. And it's my contention, two things the manager is necessary for is managing your guys from the end of one game to the beginning of the next, and bullpen usage. Well, if you can make bullpen usage a hell of a lot easier by having two Josh Haders instead of one, then the other stuff becomes that much more important.
The 815 says, David Ross needs to be the bench coach for the Cubs. Don't understand why they haven't done that yet. Why? Why does he have to be the bench coach for the Cubs?
For experience purposes, I guess.
Just so we can get a job
elsewhere.
I don't
know that he wants to be the bench coach for anybody. Right,
and the last thing you need, is any kind of speculation that a coach in waiting has been hired because they're about to part ways with Joe after the season in the last year of his deal.
Yeah, you've been asking him every day about a lame duck contract is tough. Wait until you put David Ross on the bench.
Yeah, I don't think they want to invite that. It would really surprise me. When we come back, we have chance number two for you to win $1,000 in cash on the score. And we're going to talk to Jay Jaffe. And Connor, you've got to dive into
You
need to take some video, you need to take some pictures, because there's a lot of chicken in that bag, right?
Some work to do.
See if you can declare victory over the chicken on the score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
I don't think Angel Hernandez should be umping playoff games. He's absolutely terrible. He's terrible behind the plate today. He's terrible at first base. It's amazing how he's getting a job to pitch and to play in these to umpire in these playoff games.
What did you say to him in the first inning?
Yeah. It's just a conversation for us, but he shouldn't be anywhere near a playoff game.
Is that sentiment shared by many of your teammates?
Everybody, I think.
Everybody.
I think if you go ask them on the other side, too.
CeCe, was his strike zone tonight?
It's always. Yeah. It's always. He's bad. I don't understand why he's doing these games.
Well, those aren't exactly some inscrutable roundabout comments from one CeCe Sabathia. And, you know, what does he care at this point?
Nothing.
I don't think he's got any downside to saying some of this stuff. I also don't think he's necessarily wrong. Here to talk a little bit about baseball now that we have our Final Four set is Jay Jaffe of Fangraphs on Twitter at @J_Jaffe and joining the Bernstein and McKnight show. Jay, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How you doing?
Good. What do these remaining teams say about baseball right now, if anything?
Well, you know, the Dodgers, Yankees, I'm sorry, the Dodgers and Red Sox are two of the highest payroll teams. I mean, I would say that all four of these teams are analytically driven. You know, the Red Sox obviously were kind of among the early adopters back in the Theo Epstein era. Maybe not quite as obviously analytically driven now under Dave Dombrowski, but still, you know, they still employ Bill James, for example, and still have a strong analytics department. And the other teams as well. I mean, I think the Brewers, one reason why they've been able to rebound so quickly from a rebuild, you know, is because they have a very stat-savvy front office that's found some innovative ways, and Craig Counsell has gone outside the box, particularly with regards to his bullpen usage, and that's been a key. And, of course, the Astros we know about, the Dodgers we know about. You know, they've built these two juggernauts that, you know, are quite possibly could meet again in the World Series.
So, Jay, Alex Cora went four different lineups in that series against the Yankees. He pulled Chris Sale, threw him in the bullpen in the eighth inning there. Craig Kimbrell struggled a little bit, too. What does it say about the Red Sox and Cora in general that he was as aggressive as he was this entire series?
You know, I think the big separator, you know, you had a matchup between two rookie managers there in Cora and Aaron Boone. The big separator for me was that Cora spent last year as the Astros bench coach and obviously learned a lot from that, whereas, you know, Boone was kind of flat-footed, especially with regards to bullpen usage. Cora was the aggressor there in a lot of ways. I mean, I think it's interesting, the set lineup thing, you know, the lack of a set lineup, you know, happens. You're just, you know, you've got the best guys in there day in and day out, but, you know, the changing it up, that shows you probably got, you know, you're not necessarily just going on gut instinct. You're going on numbers, and they're not necessarily the most obvious ones. It's not just lefty-righty or whatever, although, you know, or playing simple matchup numbers. I think one of the most notable things about the, you know, the way Cora managed is you look at, you know, his reasoning for Brock Holt and Rafael Devers being in the lineup the other night, they both had lousy numbers against Luis Severino in small samples. I think they were combined 1-for-27 with 11 strikeouts career-wise against them. But both of those guys did very well against velocity this year. Fastballs 95, 96 and above, they hit them well. Severino struggled a little bit against lefties, and both were in there. And then Holt, neither were in there last night against Sabathia. And you know, despite being the big offensive heroes, so I think that shows a real willingness to to stick to a plan rather than going by just this sort of playing the hot hand, doing the obvious thing.
Our guy Joe Sheehan's been tracking some numbers throughout the playoffs, and what we're seeing is 2018 trends intensify in the postseason so far. There have been 236 strikeouts to 200 hits, a 23.9% strikeout rate, mm-hmm. as opposed to 22.4% in the regular season, 43.8% of runs scored on homers, which is up from 40.3% in the regular season, and the team with more homers in a game is, so far, 11-0. It's the idea of one swing, or if more than one swing is needed, creating short sequence offense, making sure that you don't need to have these sustained innings. It's quick strike. It's a bloop and a blast. It's never been more important. Is this all because of velocity?
It's not just because of velocity. But it has a lot to do with it. It's velocity. It's players adjusting their swing planes to produce more home runs. Getting away from this notion, this longstanding notion of hitting the ball on the ground, It's all of which has been sort of analytically driven. Some of the home run stuff may have to do with the ball. We've been researching that for the last few years. But yeah, I've been reading Joe Sheehan for nearly 20 years, and the short sequence offense thing, is a line that I have ingrained in my brain and have said in many a radio spot the last few weeks. Yeah, the long ball is what wins, and because you don't get many chances to string together a rally, particularly with the unending parade of relievers, with the high velocity and the additional focus on matchups because you've got that depth and you've got those off days built in. The simplest solution is just hit the ball really far. That's what plays today. And I'm not surprised at all to hear the numbers you've said in terms of those trends and the way this is going.
Jay, if CC Sabathia is done, if his parting shot is one at Angel Hernandez, what does his Hall of Fame credential look like?
Well, I think that CC is probably a borderline case. I mean, he's been very good for a very long time, not very long as an elite, but a lot of he's got the World Series ring. He had a strong reputation for the postseason. You know, what he did in 2008 with the Brewers and 2009 with the Yankees, I think, adds to his case. But, he doesn't have, and he did win a Cy Young, but he doesn't have the year-after-year dominance sustained into his mid-30s or further the way that, some of his other peers do. When I look at him using my JAWS system, he's behind, say, Justin Verlander, who's a few years younger, and he's behind, even guys like Zach Greinke as well. But, I think he's got a shot. I do think, he's been emphatic about coming back next year in recent weeks. He'd said earlier that if the Yankees won the World Series, he was done, but he changed course and the other day said he was coming back next year. So if he does, he's got a very strong shot to get to 250 wins and to become the third left-hander ever to 3,000 strikeouts after Steve Carlton and Randy Johnson. And I think both of those things will be hooks that maybe help him in the minds of voters. I don't think he's a lock, but I do think he's got a reasonable shot.
With the acceleration of bullpenning and an understanding of a change in starting pitcher responsibility, will you have to tweak JAWS to get a better read on what it means to be an all-time great starting pitcher?
Yeah, I think we're already sort of at that point after the after Mike Mussina and Curt Schilling, who I have as among the top 30 pitchers of all time. We just don't have anybody who's anywhere close to, who's anywhere close to that level on a career or even peak level because of the lack of volume of innings. I think we're going to have to do a lot more intra era comparison adjust to what I call the workload constraint era. Five man rotations, pitch counts, third time through the order concerns, things like that. From a traditional standpoint, relatively low win totals. It was only a couple of years ago that we saw the first starters without 300 wins, in the low 200s to get in, guys like, Pedro Martinez and John Smoltz. We're going to be seeing a lot more of that in the next several years and very few 300 game winners. So, we may not have another 300 game winner for a generation here unless a guy like Kershaw or Greinke or Verlander shows exceptional stamina.
So how does that change relievers getting into the Hall of Fame the way we've seen them over the last few years?
I don't think we're going to be getting a lot of relievers in after Mariano Rivera. Mm-hmm. I think, the longevity that you need to put together a Hall of Fame career is still, the number one thing. You compare what Rivera and Trevor Hoffman did versus, the next wave of guys, Papelbon, Joe Nathan, even Billy Wagner. They just don't have the same level of longevity, Francisco Rodriguez as well, or the same level of dominance in that role that's going to make them obvious Hall of Famers. I think, we're waiting to see if guys like Craig Kimbrell and Kenley Jansen can do this for 15 years. And, we've already seen, I think, some slippage You know, and we'll see if they, bounce back to dominance. But I'm not waiting around for the next reliever to get in. It's not going to be because of one big Josh Hader type season. It's going to be 15 years of doing great things.
Last week, we read off 39 names, a list of guys that Mike Trout passed in career wins above replacement in this year alone. 39 Hall of Famers that he has leapfrogged, with another large set that is ready to be leapfrogged once again if he has another typical Mike Trout year. Is it possible that we're right now looking at the best years of the best baseball player who's ever walked the face of the earth?
I mean, you know, I think he's already in that discussion. I mean, I think you can basically make a case for the all-time greats. I think the only ones you can really put in the discussion are Babe Ruth, Willie Mays, and
Bonds.
Barry Bonds. And Mike Trout is rapidly joining them. He's certainly ahead of the pace. I have him seventh all time in Jaws, and that's with you know, seven full seasons, of which one was fairly injury marked. He has the fourth best peak WAR among center fielders, behind Mays, Cobb, and Mantle. You know, and a full representative Mike Trout season is going to easily push him into third place after next year, past Mantle. This is a remarkable player, and all he really needs is the longevity, I think, to justify a spot in the Hall of Fame. But he's done some remarkable things, and when you consider the caliber of competition that he's doing this against, the advantages in conditioning, nutrition, increased player pool from, you know, not just integration, but also the tremendous influx from Latin America, beginnings of an influx from Asia. He's doing this against the highest caliber competition. You can certainly make a case that Mike Trout is the best we've ever seen.
Jay, thanks as always. We appreciate it.
Hey, sure thing. Great talking to you guys.
That is Jay Jaffe of Fangraphs, and right now it's your chance to win $1,000 in cash on the Score. This hour's keyword is fame. Text FAME. I'm not going to break into Irene Cara.
Please don't. Please.
72881 by the end of the hour. Again, the keyword is FAME to 72881. One randomly selected nationwide entrant from this hour will win. Please do not text and drive. Message and data rates may apply. Hub Arkish belongs to us, and we talk to him next on the Score.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.